There are things that I know, but there are things that I do not. Various possible futures are happening simultaneously. I can tell you all of them, but I cannot tell you which one of them will come to pass, because every action causes ripples, consequences both obvious and unforeseen.
This is Off Planet Radio.
Welcome to Off Planet Radio. I'm Randy Moggins. Our guest today will be appearing June 28th and 29th at the Secret Space Program and Breakaway Civilization Conference being held in San Mateo, California. Guests for this include Catherine Austin Fitz, Carol Rosen, Joseph P. Farrell, Richard Dolan, Michael Schratt, John Rappaport, Mark McCandlish, and host Henrik Palmgren, as well as our guest today, Robert Morningstar. SecretSpaceProgram.org is the website. I'll also point out that this event will be streamed live, and joining me for this interview is my co-host and writer in the field of UFOs and the paranormal, Chris Hawley.
Good evening. How are you today, Randy?
I'm doing well as we head into summer. And today our guest is Robert Morningstar, best known perhaps in our circles as the co-editor of UFO Digest. He describes himself as a civilian intelligence analyst, and he is a psychotherapist in New York City. His specialty is in photo interpretation analysis and computer imaging. He graduated from Power Memorial Institute in New York City and is a New York Regents Scholar. He received his degree in psychology from Fordham University. He is an expert in Chinese language, history, and martial arts, and he is acknowledged as a master of the Yang family Tai Chi Chuan by the Hong Kong Tai Chi Masters Association. He has taught at Oberlin College and for the City University of New York at Hunter College, as well as the International Center for the Disabled. He is also an FAA-licensed pilot and instrument ground instructor with 23 years of flying experience. He has studied paranormal and UFOs for over 40 years and published multitudes of research articles on the internet exposing government cover-up and deception in the JFK assassination, and his work is cited in major books on the Kennedy assassination, notably Paris Laflon's The Assassination of America and Conspiracy Science by Professor James Fetzer. Morningstar has written extensively to expose NASA's use of disinformation technology in suppressing evidence of extraterrestrial life and exposing the real nature and threat of the UFO phenomenon. He is currently the editor of UFO Digest, and we welcome Robert Morningstar. Robert Morningstar, welcome back to Off Planet Radio.
Thanks, Randy. It's good to be here. Hello, Chris.
Nice to hear you. Hi. Oh, it's nice to be here with you tonight. We're going to talk about a subject that I've been conflicted about for a long time, and I couldn't wait to talk to you tonight, or listen to you, let's say, because I'm really looking forward to trying to form a good opinion about this, and I think you're just the person to do this, Robert.
Thank you very much. Hope to live up to that.
And the subject, Chris, is basically trending towards here is, of course, the subject of the moon and some of your discoveries about the lunar orb that sits over our planet. Robert, before we go into that, because I want to talk about the moon, I want to talk about Mars, the conference that's coming up in San Mateo at the end of June is the Secret Space Program Conference. And to kind of lead this off tonight, I don't do formula questions, but I'm real curious to know why you believe there's a secret space program, or if you do believe there's a secret space program as it's been promoted. There's been a lot of talk in the alternative media, certainly for a number of years, and a lot of this has come from Richard Dolan's work on the breakaway civilization and the concept that there is a huge black project that's been going on that has financed and created the means for us, well, not for us, for them to basically set up camp on both the moon and Mars. So my question again is, do you believe there is a secret space program and just the thumbnail version of why?
Yes, I believe there are several secret space programs. Some of them are Department of Defense compartmentalized secret programs run by the different services. And then there's another really secret space program, which I've uncovered, which is has been orbiting Earth and operating in our translunar airspace, outer space, for at least 70 years. And that's the subject that I'm going to take up at the Secret Space Conference and Breakaway Civilization conference at San Mateo, which is south of San Francisco.
Yeah, I hope to have my geography correct on that.
I believe in it because I've caught glimpses of it. I have seen that we have more than one space station around the Earth. I have seen photographs taken by a friend of mine in Hoboken, New Jersey. This man had an uncanny ability to have the camera ready at the right moment. And he has walked out of his home in Hoboken, New Jersey, and taken photographs of what I describe as a hive UFO, kind of an agglomeration of spherical UFOs that stick to each other and then change shapes and then shoot away and come back, like scout ships. And I call it a hive UFO because it reminded me when I saw it of the way hornets or bees or wasps move rapidly away from a hive and then back and then rapidly away. And then on another occasion, my friend took a photo of what is obviously a very large space station orbiting Earth. It was a daylight photograph. And the structure was like no space station that we've been shown. And it was huge. He saw it with his eye. I mean, you know, naked eye. Ran in, got his camera, put the zoom on it, and he got this amazing. And the colors were red and blue and white. And it had armatures and cross sections and things that seemed folded. And of course, people don't know that we do have several commercial outer space programs. Everybody knows about SpaceX and Richard Branson, but few people, and rarely do I see any mention of it in the paper or the news. The Bigelow Corporation is the big.
No, that's been a big subject on this show for quite a while now.
Yeah, we've been writing about it and doing shows about it, and but nobody does know, Robert, because I try and try.
Well, the media will not go there. They don't cover it. But Mr. Bigelow has been trying to build his space hotels. My recollection, it's over 10 years ago that the idea was spawned. And then there are the photographs of the Dark Knight, which is unusual spacecraft that changes shape. Got a kind of clamshell, shut clamshell appearance in space mode. But when it comes into the atmosphere, it starts to unfold like a transformer and it starts to sprout wings that are bat-like wings and a twin a rudder and tail, and the thing unfolds exactly like a transformer. It's called Black Knight. I found out about it many years ago and kept tracking it, and a few photographs came out. Apparently four photographs were taken from the space shuttle of this thing as it came into came from outer space. There's a picture of it in black space background that I've enhanced, and it appears in its clamshell, closed clamshell configuration. Then it starts to touch the high stratosphere. And as it comes in pieces, you see panels, folding wings, I would call them, start to open up and kind of start to glide down in a kind of a bat shape type of configuration. And then I have, I watch the NASA channel a lot, and I had a really interesting experience the other day when they were in the chamber, the center, the control, mission control for the space station. And I took some photographs off the screen because in the left-hand corner of this mission control, there was a huge, huge TV panel, you know, high-definition TV panel, and there were four quadrants in it. And in two of the quadrants were two views of the space station that we all know,
right,
the ISS. But in the other two quadrants was a space station that I've only seen once before, and I think they keep it out of sight. And I can't describe it any better way than to say it was the Walt Disney Space Station from 1954, Tomorrowland.
Mm.
A wheel-shaped space station with a central cross section, like tubular cross section, through which astronauts could walk through an X or a cross, and joined to a cylindrical outer ring. And there it was in the, and they were in different regions of the Earth. Here's the other interesting part. The ISS was in a daylight region of the Earth, and the wheel was in a twilight region of the Earth, like floating right along the terminator, because you could tell from one angle of the panels that you saw it just slightly illuminated, like sunset kind of lighting. And on the other side, you saw it silhouetted against the light as a dark form, a darkened form with edges. So I believe that we're not the only ones that are in outer space, and that's obvious. And there has been, since 1950, there has been a regular visitor to the equatorial orbit, which has been described as a mothership, which dropped off scout ships, and it's pretty well known. So we've been visited for more than 70 years. I mean, I say 70 years because the records start off with the 1940s, 38, and the crashes in Missouri, Port Girardeau.
Right, right.
Even earlier, the U.S. Navy has been monitoring UFOs since the 1890s and World War One period, and that's why the U.S. Navy has the lead in UFOs. They have the charter that mandates them to investigate unusual paranormal phenomena, such as, you know, ESP, parapsychology, and UFOs. So that's their domain, which leads us to the rumors of the secret U.S. Navy 10th Fleet. It does exist, but on paper it's a cybernetic, electronic organization, and in the rumor mill, it's what the real starships and starship officers are listed. For example, the Gary McKinnon crash.
Yeah, I was going to mention that. Gary McKinnon, yeah.
You know, that list of extraterrestrial officers, yeah, and the list of off-world ships, it all seems to dovetail.
For listeners who don't know, Gary McKinnon back in, I want to say 2005, 2006, was in the process of being extradited by the United States for hacking into military computers and finding information related to the Starfleet Command and a list of officers, as you just outlined there.
Yep, and it was he was the first one to cite a U.S. Navy space fleet. But that's not surprising to me. Every service, you know, people talk about branches of the, you know, it's
right,
not branches. There are three services, and the services within themselves have branches. So the three services, since the 1950s, the earliest one that I remember is Project Moondust, which was a U.S. Army program to launch a colony and establish a colony on the moon. Many people say it was started and conducted and had some initial success at landing and creating a base on the moon that was powered by a small nuclear reactor like the one in Thule, Greenland. You know about Thule, Greenland, when we had the SAC bases and the Dew Line. Greenland was a big North American Defense Center.
Yeah.
And he created ice caves and built a colony in the ice, and that was kind of a model for what they expected we would have to do on the moon. And so we've heard rumors of Project Moondust, and of course, legendary U.S. Air Force, CIA, military-industrial complex is a reality. Remind everyone that President Eisenhower is the one who labeled it. And it's interesting, I've read recently that President Eisenhower's speech was edited, and that the original phrase was not military-industrial complex, but military-industrial pharmaceutical complex. But they scratched the word pharmaceutical from his speech. Mm-hmm. You think he was trying to tell us something? I think so.
Yeah. They sanitized a lot of this, but unfortunately, it's kind of like when JFK made his famous speech exposing the conspiracies of the secret societies.
Right.
That's kind of not been able to be expunged from the records, but it's obviously right. ignored by mainstream.
Mm-hmm. It's clear to me that President Kennedy knew the plots were up and running against him, both from inside and outside the government.
Let me ask you a tangential question, but it popped into my head. In 1960, JFK started the Defense Intelligence Agency largely because of his mistrust of Dulles and the CIA at that time. Do you believe that was also his attempt to commandeer back the covert operations that were taking place as part of these secret space programs?
Sure. That was, you see, I've discovered a very interesting thing about the Kennedys. The Kennedys were tremendously anti-Nazi. They had lost Joe Kennedy Jr. to the Nazis, you know, in World War II. So it turns out that Joseph P. Kennedy warned Eisenhower about the Dulles brothers. He told them, I know these guys. They were charged with trading with the enemy.
Right.
And I prosecuted them. Joseph P. Kennedy prosecuted the Dulles brothers under the Trading with the Enemies Act. He then pointed out to Eisenhower that the Dulles brothers fed false information to the U.S. Army to slow down the advance through the Black Forest and through southern Germany and Austria, giving General Wolfe, a friend of theirs, some time to escape with his troops. And Joseph P. Kennedy warned Eisenhower, don't trust these men. They're into operations, they'll run operations behind your back and force you to form your policy to cover their operations. And Eisenhower at first was going to get rid of them, but then he relented and he allowed them to stay. And an interesting thing I've discovered in the last year, the famous James Jesus Angleton, the chief of counterintelligence in the CIA, on his deathbed, he confessed that the way he got the job as chief of counterintelligence was to promise Alan Dulles that neither he or his brother would be given a polygraph test to get their security clearances. So all the dirt is coming out in the wash, you know? And we now know that the plot to kill Castro was a joint venture mm-hmm. between the mafia and the, I would say it's the National Security Agency at that time, not just the CIA, because each one had a seat, the NSA, the CIA, the FBI, and the military had representatives, a seat in what was called the 5412 Committee. And that was the assassination arm, the executive action. When we say executive action, we're talking about execute, you see? So
what
information has come out in the last couple of years,
yeah.
and you can see clearly how the assassination apparatus that was initiated to assassinate Castro was turned on JFK, and primarily by his principal enemy, Lyndon Johnson, who inherited chairmanship of the committee as vice president from Richard Nixon. So I think it's really pretty clear-cut. All the cards are on the table, and we can read it, you know, we can read it. We can read the deck.
The other side of this, Robert, and you and I talked a little bit about this off-air earlier today, has to do with the way this has all been financed and organized right under the nose of the American people because of the way that accounting or lack thereof is done in terms of, off-books military expenditures. And then the logistics of it as well, having highly compartmentalized units, as you explained earlier, within branches of the different services and the different intelligence agencies. Can you give us any of your take on the logistics in terms of finance and the organizational structure behind these programs?
Well, as I mentioned to you earlier, having read the document, the contract between Reinhard Galen and the United States government, initially with the U.S. Army and then to form the Central Intelligence Agency, one of the specific terms of the contract was that the budget, the financing, would come from monies that would be off the congressional record. They would not be shown in Congress or in budgets, and that these had to be funneled to them through secret channels. And that's where I mentioned to you, it appears that the Central Intelligence Agency decided to take over the drug cartels operations in Southeast Asia to control the Golden Triangle. That one of the main reasons for the war in Vietnam was not just to keep the Red Chinese out of Vietnam and to keep the Chinese and the Vietnamese from getting the oil deposits that are off the coast of Vietnam, but equally important, to wrest away from the mafia, the French Corsican mafia, the control of the Golden Triangle and the world drug trade. And thereby using, if they could execute that feat, take over the business, you might say, they would use the monies to fund black programs, black operations. So I am inclined to believe that. And if you read Alfred McCoy's Heroin and the Politics of Southeast Asia, you'll find some very interesting characters who were in Dealey Plaza are also actors in Vietnam, particularly Colonel Lansdale, Edward Lansdale, who's famous for appearing in the picture with the tramps, and another picture appearing with George Bush in Dealey Plaza. This photograph's only come out in the last 2 years. So, it's for your question. You know, it all comes out in the wash. That's all I can say, you know, with the information technologies that we have. And that's what you're talking about, by the way, information technology management of, and the packaging of information to hide the pertinent facts from the American public. And that's how the loot was taken. We were speaking about the day before 9/11, on 9/10/2001, Rumsfeld, Secretary of Defense, announced that they had lost $4.5 billion. They just didn't know where it went, you know? So, and you asked me about the funding of the secret space program, I'd say, well, let's start looking there. $4.5 billion lost on September 10th, and then September 11th, the towers come down, and all of it's forgotten in the rubble.
And that's, you know, that's the most fascinating part of all of this, Roger, Robert, is that so much of this information is out there in different bits and pieces, but because of the attention span of the average person and the fact that the mainstream media press, who supposedly represent information, not only have failed to present the information, but in fact have been active agents for suppressing all of this information.
Well, you know, I agree with you. The problem that they have is that one lie leads to another. As I've said for years, the truth is seamless. There are no breaks, no disjunctions, no cuts, no alterations. It's seamless, a whole cloth, you know?
Yeah.
And then when the lie happens, it's like a tear. It's a tear in the fabric. And then the stitching, the repair starts. And that's the analogy I have about the doctoring of the Zapruder film. The Zapruder film, as it was shot, really showed what really happened in Dealey Plaza. But because what happened could not be shown, i.e. that 6 to 9 shots were fired, that 5 of the shots hit the victims, the governor and the president, and that some came from behind and some came from street level and some 2 came from the front, that the man was riddled with bullets from different directions, but the only way to make the single bullet theory, or the single gunman theory, magic bullet theory, was the only solution. And so if 5 shots were fired and hit, and they had to reduce it to 3 shots were fired, 1 missed, and 2 hit, what they did is they cut out the time between the arrival of shot number 1 and shot number 2, left in shot number 2, the shot that missed, then took out shots number 3, and then merge shots 4 and 5 into 1 event. That's literally what happened. The 2 shots at the grassy knoll are what destroyed President Kennedy's head. And it was a shot that arrived 1, 2, like that. And in that 1, 2 is about 3/4 to 1 second. That's 18 frames, if you believe the FBI, 18 frames per second. So though that is obvious, I have seen the missing frames of the Zapruder film, and it's obvious that 2 shots hit. But in the altered version, which everyone's been seeing for 50 years, not 50 years, 45 or so, because they kept it secret for 5 years. Nobody saw it until really in the 70s sometime. But anyway, having seen it, I can tell you that they removed the frames between the impact of the first grassy knoll shot and the passage of the second grassy knoll shot, and all the actions that happened in between, and quite a lot of action happened. Jackie put her arm around Jack. Her arm was around his neck. The bullets opened up the wound. The other one flew through. She almost lost her arm. She is the hero. Jackie Kennedy is the only hero in Dealey Plaza. All the rest is bunk to cover up, to create fake heroes, to cover up the Secret Service's bungling and or participation. Not all of them, but some of them knew something was up.
You know, in a lot of ways, and I know we touched on this last November, that event that day was almost like the framework for everything that would follow in the 60s and the 70s. It was their ability to finally pull off something that big and that deceptive and have the general public swallow it, the strategy that they used right up to 9/11, when I think a whole lot of people started to get hip about what was really going on with their so-called government.
Right. Well, you know, we mentioned The Wizard of Oz and how it was in 1963 that the government arrived at the point where it had control of mass media technology to the point where it could filter all the information. I pointed out before that the Kennedy assassination was the first time there was something called pool reporting. Prior to that, every world event was a nest of ratty reporters ferrying out all of the dirt, all the garbage, and getting to the truth and vying with each other for the scoop and trying to beat each other to the story. And then Dallas happened, and there were so many thousands, hundreds of reporters in there. I would say there were a thousand reporters were in Dallas. And if they had been let loose, they would have really torn this whole thing apart. But what they did is they created the information headquarters in the Dallas Police Department, and then pool reporting began, and then only the official version would be filtering out. But even in the process of filtering out the undesired reports, like the chief detective, the chief deputy sheriff, Alan Sweat, was pulled over by the powers that be on the weekend of November 22nd, 23rd, 24th, because he was going around saying to people, oh yeah, I heard the shots over there on Main Street, I ran, and it was six or seven shots at least. He was telling everybody, six or seven shots at least, I heard them, Harry Weatherford was running with me. And so all of that had to be suppressed, and I have the memo that's called the McCone-Raleigh memo. McCone, the head of the CIA, wrote to Raleigh, the head of the James Raleigh, head of the Secret Service, and told them that they really needed to keep out of the public eye the fact that Oswald had worked for the agency, had been trained by them, had infiltrated the Soviet Union. Gave a whole list. His whole history is there. He served in Camp Perry. He was stationed at LTA, which is a code word for lighter than air, which is where he was learning how to be what they call a scope dope, you know, the air traffic controllers for the U-2 that watch the screens. The Marines called those guys scope dopes. So Oswald was a scope dope, which is not a bad thing. I mean, you had to be a bright, bright fellow to be in charge of running air traffic control and communications for U-2 flights into the Soviet Union, which is what he was doing in Atsugi, Japan. So all of it's come out, and so they were really concerned that the connection between the CIA and Oswald would come out, and what they really wanted to push was Oswald was a communist. Oswald loved Castro. Oswald killed President Kennedy because he was a communist fanatic. And what he was, in fact, and the memo emphasizes it, that after he came back from the Soviet Union, Oswald was useless as a secret agent. But he was given menial jobs, a menial task of infiltrating different organizations in New Orleans and Dallas, both right-wing and left-wing organizations. And so he would go to General Walker's Minuteman meetings, and then he would go to meetings of the American Civil Liberties Society. Then a year and a half ago, a report came out that somebody in an astronomy club met Oswald, and that Oswald, he was infiltrating astronomy clubs, anti-Castro Cubans, pro-Castro Cubans. That's why he got beat up in, you know the story in New Orleans about the street fight?
Yes, I remember hearing that. Yeah,
because a Cuban that he'd met at a pro-Castro...
Oh, yeah, that's right.
...saw him handing out anti-Castro leaflets and said, hey, what are you doing? Weren't you at our meeting the other day? And that's how the altercation began with the pro-Castro, the anti-Castro Cuban... accusing him of being an infiltrator, and both of them got arrested. It's a very interesting 8mm film of that that's come out. Very interesting.
I want to move the conversation slightly sideways here, because what hasn't come out, and I know, and I think I heard you tell the story that John F. Kennedy did in fact have a UFO sighting while he was on his yacht. So it's not a surprise to those of us who have paid attention that there was an awareness of extraterrestrial or at least UFO presence. What I want to ask you, Robert, is do we have reason to believe that there are extraterrestrial presence within the secret space program, that this is the source of the technology and the source of the wherewithal that gave us the jump start in the first place to do this?
As far as I know, there are two sources of extraterrestrial technology. One is the reverse-engineered Roswell type of material, crash at Aztec, the crash at Port Girardeau, which is earlier. It's 1940 in Missouri. It's 7 years earlier than Roswell.
Yes.
A body was recovered. So there's the gray technology, which is reverse-engineered. But then there's another technology which has been shared with us by adversaries of the Greys, and those are the Nordics. And those are the giants, the 6-foot, 7-foot tall alien, extraterrestrial astronauts. And I do believe Clark McKellen's account of having seen these giant astronauts conversing with our astronauts in the shuttle bay, a shuttle cargo bay that opened up.
Right, yes, I remember.
Yeah, and I'm quite close to Clark. I've had long conversations with him about his terrible experience at NASA and his dismissal for having walked into a room that and seeing a screen that he was not supposed to see, that NASA's monitoring extraterrestrial activity in pretty far reaches of the solar system. And he wandered in there and he looked at the screen, he saw what was going on, and they said, "Hey man, you're not supposed to be here. What are you doing here? You broke the rules." They threw him out. No pension, nothing. Just out on his own, and he's suffering terribly. If anybody wants to help Clark McKellen, go to the Stargate Chronicles and please buy his book. It would be a very small contribution to a great man who was science officer on the space shuttle programs. That means that he was trained like an astronaut, for example, to mimic all of the actions of the astronauts in problem solving. The way we saw Gary Sinise play the astronaut who figured out the problems of Apollo 13 as a shadow pilot, I would call him. But what Clark McKellen saw was a deployment of a satellite from the space shuttle bay while in the background a giant triangle spaceship was parked and monitoring the operation. He then saw three American astronauts, or three human astronauts, interacting with two giant-sized astronauts that were acting and signaling to them in language and gestures in the shuttle cargo bay. And then they departed and went back to the Black Triangle, and the shuttle closed the bay, and the shuttle astronauts came home. So it is believed that there is an alliance between the Nordics, the tall whites, as they're called in Charles Hall, millennial.
Right, yeah.
Charles Hall has a lot of experience, and his books are worth reading.
Oh, those are wonderful books. I've read those.
Yeah, I think he gives and his interviews. You can go to YouTube and hear him speak on certain things that are very. Another one is Clifford Stone. Clifford Stone was a U.S. Army man who was then in Army intelligence and then recruited into CIA. And he relates how the first the Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit was actually formed by General MacArthur in 1943 as a detachment. I think the number was 4035, Detachment 4035, as a specialized unit to go into areas to recover crash disks or deal with the Celestians. They used to call it extraterrestrials at one time Celestians because they came from the sky. You know?
It's probably a better name.
Yeah, I know. It's a kind of a gentle name before you get to alien, extraterrestrial, and EBE, extraterrestrial biological entity.
Right. Well, that was the term given by the military.
Yeah, I think Grays is good enough. They're very creepy fellows.
Yeah, that's your basic food groups right there. Wow.
Yeah. But our hope is that, you know, that the alliance between the tall whites, the Nordics, and the U.S. government is what protects the United States from completely being overrun by gray activity. There are two shamans, I forgot their names, but they work in South America, and they're brothers. And in meditech.org, their essay about the gray activity in South America and how they've been manipulating Central and South America and just run rampant all over it. But that when they come to the United States, when they visited, they feel, as soon as they get off the airplane, they could almost kiss the ground because they feel a shield of protection. Something is protecting our country from the devious and cunning activities of the Greys. And if it were not for this protective power, spiritual power, we would be at their mercy. As bad as it is, you know, with people disappearing, cattle mutilations, mind control subjects, hybridization subjects, it would be far worse without this this alliance.
Yeah, that's interesting you would mention that, because I had just read something a few days ago that indicated the same thing, that somehow or another we do have some level of protection, that we're not being overrun, which I guess I've always wondered the whole extraterrestrial thing was, my understanding for a long time was we were somewhat in quarantine, at least in terms of the beings who would have observed a quarantine, but that things opened up significantly at the time of the detonation of the nuclear bombs. What's your take on that?
Now, the detonation of the nuclear bombs, of course, is something that would have been noticed by anyone that's watching Earth, you know, especially if somebody's observing the Earth from the moon. And the other possibility is that the Greys are not interstellar voyagers, but actually
local to our galaxy,
local yokels, as I say.
Yeah.
Local to our solar system, not even our galaxy, that life could have sprung up early in farther regions farther out than this life zone, you know, Earth and Mars being the limit. No, people don't know that at one time Saturn was a sun.
Yes.
And we were a binary star system, and the moons of Saturn were actually little planets incubating, and Jupiter as well. And we were a triple sun system, but they shut down. Our sun somehow overwhelmed the energy field, and they lost their fusion reaction and cooled down into gas giants. But in 1949, part of Project Sign was the recruiting of the world's top astronomers and astronomical observatories to observe these motherships that I mentioned earlier in our conversation that had come in and been sighted orbiting equatorial orbit of the Earth and coming and going, like changing stations. So they asked astronomers to track these fleets of flying saucers, as they referred to them, and to see where they went and where they came from. And they noticed that they went to the moon, came back from the moon, but on other journeys, they went way out. And when they tracked them to Saturn's moon, Titan.
Mm-hmm.
And we have the Huygens program that's gone in there, and it reveals Titan to be the most, topographically, the most Earth-like planet of all the planets we've seen, with, you know, land masses, mountains, lakes, except the lakes and the oceans and the seas are made of liquid methane, and it's incredibly cold. And so they thought, oh, you know, life can't exist there. But a couple of years ago, some biologists, astrobiologists, in fact, working in Mono Lake, California, found a life form that's based on strychnine, a strychnine-based life form. Oh, no, excuse me, not strychnine, arsenic. Arsenic is the word.
Right.
So the arsenic molecule becomes the basis of this little bit of DNA. But on Earth, the arsenic does not last long because of the high temperature. It disintegrates. And so this organism has to continue to process and acquire arsenic in order to keep its metabolism. So it really can't develop much farther than, you know, a single-celled organism. But the professor, Professor Wolfson, said an interesting thing. She said, now, here on Earth, it cannot persist and it cannot propagate and develop. But on another planet with a much colder environment, perhaps something like Saturn's moon Titan, it could thrive and develop. I was stunned, you know. And now, in the years since that happened, academia and astrobiology has turned against these scientists and just tried to shoot down their experiments from every possible angle. There's, you know, contamination, poor statistics, unable to replicate it. They go after you. Once you come out with a nugget of truth in this field, which is affirming the possibility of life on other planets, and life different than our own, the hammer comes down on people, you know. Carl Sagan, perfect example.
Yeah.
Oh, the ultimate black operator. Once he wrote The Dragons of Eden, inferring extraterrestrial life intelligence, they shut him out. You know, he became a pariah. And Richard Hoagland tells a story about Carl Sagan. I met Carl Sagan once. He lectured at the Cathedral of St. John the Divine. But, the way he moved through the audience, I looked at him and I said, my God, this man looks like a man who does not want to have a question asked of him. You know what I mean? He was an aura. He put an aura, a field around himself. Like you can see, mm-hmm. Please don't ask me any questions. You know, the body language thing?
Yeah. This is the pose of the expert, the appointed.
Yeah, it was very interesting. The audience was there, listened to him, appreciated him, but when he came down from the podium, he walked through that audience with such a mindset and such a shield around him that I looked at him and I said, man, he's leaving he's cutting through this audience like a hot knife through butter, you know? There was no way he was going to just stop and chit-chat and hear great conference or, you know, what is Mars like, because he knows. He knew. And he kept it. He's, you know, a black operator, like a lot of them. So it leaves it to people like you and me and, there are very, very good scientific organizations that are counter NASA. One of them is the American Association of Aeronautics and Astronautics, AIAA, of which I was a member, and I am very proud to have been a member, to continue to support them, and to have been invited by them to give a peer-reviewed lecture at Johns Hopkins University on my observations of the planet Mars. Made in 2003 when I saw the Eye of Mars and the total destruction of the Martian ecosystem was the result of huge meteor asteroid impacts which cracked the planet and left a hole in it so deep that it remains black. The pit remains black until the sun has reached around 10:30 or 11 o'clock. And so for this reason, in the early morning or the late afternoon, as the sun is at a low angle, when that part of Mars is turned toward Earth, it looks like an eye. And the way it looks like Alice Cooper's eye. It looks like a black pupil, bleeding a black tear. And I'm very proud to have published the first actual photograph of the Eye of Mars, because people have been seeing it for 100 years. Percival Lowell saw it, but they never published a picture of it. So I was able, on April 9th this year, when Mars came to its closest since, I would say, 2007,
yeah,
it was, I think it was 42 million miles away. So I got up there with two great telescopes and my digital camera, and I said, I got to take pictures. And fortunately, luckily, I was able to capture a really fine single shot that shows the abyss. That's what I call the Eye of Mars, is an abyss. And it's an impact crater so deep, as it has to be at least 100 miles deep, possibly more.
Now, were you able to do some enhancements on that picture and get any more detail out of it, Robert?
Well, actually, I did. I was the picture was kind of fuzzy, but the detail, when you know the planet Mars as I do, I was thrilled to see it, because I was able to get the red line of the Valles Marineris and the descent of the slopes of Sinai into Solis Locus. Solis Locus is what this area is called, and the the photo that I got that, it's a practically perfect corner. And then by reducing the glare of the planet, I was able to bring out the boring that it augured in, you know? It's like it just bored into the planet, cracked the planet along a seam, you know, that's 2,500 miles long. Grand Canyon from New York to San Diego, 18 mile wide, 4 miles deep, makes the Grand Canyon look like a ditch, to be honest with you.
Do you think that Mars is unpopulated, or do you think that there are life forms that have survived the cataclysms there?
I believe that life exists on Mars, and I've found evidence of at least vegetable plant life. In the Dingo Gap, the Curiosity rover went into the Dingo Gap and took some panoramic photographs, high-resolution stuff. I was able to get some, and I was able... They set up a situation where you could control the camera, and as I panned around, I was shocked by the things that I was finding. You know, the coincidences of the fact that Cairo means Mars in Arabic, the city of Cairo. Means Mars.
Yes, yes.
That there's so much red stone used in the building of pyramids, especially here, the Red Pyramid, the Bent Pyramid. I think it all points to the sky, and maybe Noah's Ark started off on Mars, and that the symbol of the flood, it symbolizes something even more ancient than just Noah and a local flood. If you find this article about the four faces of Mars that I wrote years ago, I had an insight that the building of the three pyramids at Giza was to terraform a certain region of Mars. You know how Japanese gardens landscape,
right.
Garden to create
right.
The illusion of a river, the miniature of something else? Well, I finally saw the big picture in 1997, discovered something regarding Mars and the plain of Giza, and I concluded that the three pyramids of Giza are models of the three volcanoes known as the Tarsus Montes, which have a relationship to Olympus Mons. So if you think of a screen, television screen in front of yourself, you have put your palm up in the upper left-hand corner. That would be Olympus Mons. Then you would come down diagonally to the center of the screen and put three fingers in the center of the screen diagonally from lower left to upper right. Those would be the three volcanoes known as the Tarsus Montes. And then going farther to the right of that, you would arrive at the Eye of Mars, Solus Lacus, and the Valles Marineris. And I studied Mars, as you can tell, for so long that, you know, I can walk you across it. That night, I happened to see something. And what it was that there was a corresponding mountain in Egypt that corresponds to Olympus Mons. And that mountain is called Al-Wajit. And it means, I have found it. Al-Wajit means I have found it. It turns out that this mountain is the real, true Mount Olympus of legend. And the way it's proven is that the legend of Alexander the Great stated that Alexander the Great became a demigod and that he was buried on Mount Olympus to reside with the gods. What people don't know is that Alexander the Great was initiated as the Pharaoh of Egypt, initiated into the Egyptian teachings, acknowledged as the son of God, buried in Egypt, and not found until 1994 because they went through Greece and the Mount Olympus in Greece and they never found a single bone of Alexander. And 2,500 years or 2,300 years they looked and didn't find anything. In 1994 they found the body of Alexander the Great in a crypt buried in Al-Wajit, Mount Olympus. Now, why do you think Carl Sagan and Philip Morrison and all of these astronomers gave these names to Mars? Greek names. They named some parts Sinai.
Yeah.
They name another part Syria. They name another one Olympus Mons, and so on and so forth. They saw the legends of the Greek gods revealed to them. When they saw the first pictures that the mariners had sent back from Mars and then the Viking, and he said, holy mackerel, just like Robert did in 1997, holy mackerel, look, the three volcanoes of the Tarsus Mountains and the Olympus Mons line up with Giza and Egypt. What the audience needs to know is that the Giza Plateau is adjacent to the Nile River, which runs north-south, and to the west of Giza is the deepest depression in the Mediterranean region, the Great Qatar Depression. And it's a sinkhole, basically, that sinks down 450 feet below sea level and then rises up into this range of mountains that begin to create the border with Libya. And the highest peak in that range, visible on a clear day from Giza, is Al-Wajid. And there are sacred healing waters there. I was told by Egyptians that legendary, miraculous healings, there's a special pool, it's an oasis there, and that the waters come up and Egyptians go there to be healed, kind of like Lourdes in France, you know, and the sacred waters of the stream there. So we're inching our way to realizing that we are not who we've been told we are. We didn't get here by way of the monkey alone. And we've had company all along the way. And that's what I'm going to show at the Space Conference. The company that we're keeping secret. Company we're keeping and company we're keeping secret. that has a vast space fleet on the far side of the moon. And this space fleet has been photographed repeatedly, and I have discovered the best photographs of it found to date, and I'm looking forward to sharing that with everyone at the Secret Space Conference, and hopefully we'll all walk away with a breakaway civilization, you know, and a breakaway consciousness that has to precede that.
And you're speaking America specifically here about Robert, about our consciousness shifting, because we're giving them far too much credit in saying they're the breakaway civilization. They're the ones that basically want to toss a match onto everything and then fly off the planet and leave us here with a cinder block to live on.
Yeah, well, my point is we are already the breakaway civilization. See, Americans cannot imagine what we Americans look like to foreign third world people. You don't know how the organization of an American city, the traffic, the gadgetry we have. You know, President Sukarno of Indonesia once said a very interesting thing. I mean, he said many interesting things, but one sociological thing in the 1960s. He said, you Americans don't realize how powerful movies are, and you don't realize what it looks like to a third world person to see an American in a movie go up to a refrigerator and open the door of a refrigerator and to see all that food in the refrigerator and then close the door, take the food and go and eat. You don't understand what that is to a third world person who has to live off the land, who has to forage for food. It's magic to them to see a refrigerator opened and all that food in there already. It makes them want it. It makes them want to have that. So we've been the breakaway civilization for the rest of the world for ages. But even within ourselves, our consciousnesses are evolving extremely rapidly. And now in the era of the internet, a large group of people worldwide are connecting minds,
yes,
and creating a synergy, a noosphere, as Teilhard de Chardin called it, the field, the sphere of mind. And it's uncanny how we're connected by our thoughts.
And that's where we're going to end it for hour one of this interview with our guest, Robert Morningstar. Again, the Secret Space Program information can be found at secretspaceprogram.org, where you can purchase tickets to attend the live event or attend the live stream over your computer. This will be live streamed as well. And we encourage you to support this outreach of alternative media to bring the truth out. This has to do not only with UFOs and secret space programs and black budgets, but with free energy and the technology that has been hidden and suppressed. We'll return in the next hour with an extended interview with our guest, Robert Morningstar. I'm Randy Moggins. This is Off Planet Radio. You can find these recordings and other shows like it at offplanetradio.com or offplanetradio.net.
This is Off Planet Radio.